theater, there is a principle known as Chekhov's gun. It comes from something once said by Anton Chekhov, the great Russian author and playwright. You mustn't put a loaded rifle on stage if no one intends to fire it. You shouldn't make promises. Chekhov, who was also a doctor and a very wise man, knew what he was talking about.
He's the most produced playwright after Shakespeare, and there are a lot of guns in his plays.
That's Laura Straussfeld, a Chekhov expert. She is a visiting scholar at Columbia University's Harriman Institute.
The use of Chekhov's gun implies a certain number of things. For example, that there's something inherently dangerous. Someone will get hurt.
So if you're a writer, which I happen to be, you don't put something in your story, something potentially explosive, unless it's going to explode. You don't, for instance, introduce a nice Midwestern couple just to talk about how nice they are. I've never asked anyone this question before, but as marriages go, on a scale of like 1 to 10, 10 being the best, how would you rate your marriage?
I would say presently.
Wait, before you do it, hang on. I both want you to say the number at the same time.
Oh my goodness.
Dear.
You're brutal.
I know, I am brutal. So I'm gonna say 1, 2, 3, and then I want you each to say the number. So think your number, but don't say it. Okay? Got it? Now?
Yes.
Okay.
1, 2, 3.
6. 8.
Wow.
All right.
Oh.
This Chekhov's gun is in your life. You know, the stuff is going to go down, and you will with it.
So what was the vibe between you two when you went to bed that night?
Oh, it was not good.
It was horrible.
And what was it that made the vibe so horrible? What was it that knocked this marriage down to an 8 or a 6?
It's a princess cut, 1 carat, and it is really nice. It's a beautiful diamond.
From WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
We're on the line with a couple from Grand Ledge, Michigan. That's a suburb of Lansing.
My name's Jason Serrata.
And I am Kristen Serrata.
Kristen and Jason are both turning 40 this year. They have 2 kids, a boy and a girl. Kristen is a nurse and nursing supervisor at a hospital emergency room in Lansing. She works a night shift. Jason is a paramedic with the fire department there. He's also working toward becoming a financial advisor. Jason and Kristen have a lot in common. How they think about money is not one of those things.
To kind of give you a small example, we moved from a smaller home to a nicer, larger home probably about 7 years ago. And within the first 3 or 4 months there, I was looking at our kitchen table light and making a grocery list. And on that grocery list had light bulbs. And as I'm looking at the table, you know, it's like a 5 or 6 light bulb chandelier, and 3 of them are out. And he looks at my grocery list and says, "Why are you getting light bulbs?" And I said, "Well, we're already burned out." He said, "They're not burned out. I just unscrewed them a teeny little bit so that," and I said, "Well, why did you do that?" And he said, "Well, we don't, you know, it's the cost, the energy savings, as well as we don't actually need this much light right here." And as I started going through the house and paying attention, you know, in our bathroom, we have the Jack and Jill sinks, and there's 3 light bulbs above my sink, 3 above his, and, you know, 1 is screwed out on each side. And so the way he thinks is, yes, we can have that, but do we need to have that?
And that is the crux of their difference. Jason divides everything into needs versus wants. Kristen doesn't. They've been together 13 years.
We met one night out where I said I would never meet my future wife, and that was at a bar.
Jason had a list of very specific things that when he met his wife, she was going to, you know, be A, B, and C. And so, for an example, one of the things that he had always said was, you know, my the woman I meet is, I'm not going to meet her in a bar. Her parents will be married still, and my parents have been divorced since I was six. She's not going to swear nor smoke. And at the time, I broke all of those rules for him. So I no longer smoke at all.
Do you still swear?
I do.
Only when she's mad at me.
What he's leaving out is I think he kind of had a little wild past, and then he became what I call, you know, born again Christian somewhere in his early to mid 20s, and then that's where his big list of things came from.
One item on Jason's list is a conservative approach to family finance. This is apparently why Jason rates their marriage as only a 6.
If I submitted to all of Jason's financial rules, then it would be a 10. That's where it lies.
Oh. So what does he want you to do financially that you're not doing?
Not spend one dime.
A few months ago, a neighborhood friend invited them to a Christmas party that was a fundraiser for a local agency called Child and Family Charities.
She just sent me this text message. Hey, are you guys available? Do you want to come and do this thing? So I look it up online, and it lists the costs for a couple as like $220 or $250 for a couple to go. And she hadn't specified in the text message whether we were coming as, you know, on her, or like, do you want to come and this is what you have to pay? So I mentioned it to Jason. He's like, you need to figure that part out first, because that's gonna affect our decision.
So Kristen texted the friend back.
I kind of said, you know, tell me more about this. Is there, you know, a cost and things like that? I played like I hadn't looked into it. And she responded with, yes, there's a cost, but you'd be coming as, you know, our guest.
To Jason, this looked like a pretty good deal. Free tickets to a nice fancy party with dinner and drinks. They didn't even need a babysitter. Kristen's mom lives with them and looks after the kids. The friends who invited Kristen and Jason even drove them to the party.
So we didn't even pay for gas.
Yeah, I don't. See, that's how my mind is supposed to work.
Okay, yeah. See, you're rubbing off on her.
Yeah, exactly.
I just know how we think, so.
Yeah.
By the time they walked into the benefit, Kristen had just one concern.
I was a little anxious, thinking, I really hope he's not planning on going in there and then we just reap the benefit and then he does not make any contribution.
Now, to his credit, Jason says he was fully prepared to contribute. There was going to be a silent auction that he planned to bid in.
That week, I could do a couple $100s, if not more.
But once they started looking around, they realized that the silent auction items, restaurant gift cards, things like that, even these were going for more than a couple $100s. Then Jason noticed there was something else going on besides the silent auction.
There's one table off by itself that had a bunch of champagne glasses on it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I walk over and say, you know, what's this table for? And they explain that it's a raffle. You can win a loose diamond.
A local jeweler had donated a diamond that was estimated to be worth $7,500. For $35, you got a glass of champagne and one raffle ticket for the diamond. Two tickets and two glasses of champagne for $50. Jason, being Jason, wanted to know more.
My first question was, well, how many of these tickets are you selling?
Makes sense. You're trying to calculate your odds?
Well, it does.
Did they know how many tickets were being sold for the diamond?
Yeah, she said, I want to say right around 250 to 300 is what she said.
And okay, all right.
I'm like, okay, well, yeah, give me two.
So did you really think about winning and like that would be a really good investment, $50 for $7,500 diamond? Or were you just thinking this is kind of the sensible way for me to contribute?
For me, I thought that would be a really good investment. I looked at the odds and said, you know what, that's pretty good odds. You know, it's not that bad.
Later in the evening, there was a live auction with bigger items up for bid. A ski weekend, a catered meal cooked in your home.
They had a fast talker and some spotters to accept your order. And so you can wave your card up, your card with your number on it.
I'll work with you. 675 one time. 675.
And these were way, way above Kristen and Jason's budget. So here they are, sitting on their hands at this fundraiser, which they got comped into by their friend, who's sitting at the same table. And did you feel compelled to spend some more for the charity since you were sitting there? Or was it awkward or not really?
Well, towards the end of the auction, they said, you know, for anybody that wants to just donate, you can just raise your card and we'll come to you and you just give whatever amount you have. You know,
oh, that's so nice of them.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Well, but I don't think it was awkward at any point.
No,
I mean,
she
invited us with an expectation that, you know, come. I think some of it too is, in all honesty, trying to fill her table as well.
Yeah, and you guys sound like good company. I mean, I would want you at my table at a dinner.
Well, thank you.
Fun. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We think we're fun too.
We're usually entertaining. Yes, as they're offering up, you know, after all the live auction is done and they're saying, you know, if you just want to make a donation now, and some people were, I mean, they were making, you know, pretty large donations. And our friend Sarah, she said, is anyone interested in maybe just making, you know, I think she had said, Jason, maybe $50 or, you know, just a donation. And she opened it up to the whole table. You know, I think we're going to do that. Is anybody else interested? And that was when Jason said, well.
I look at her and I said, well. I said, well, I look over at the table that's selling the raffle tickets, and all the glasses are not sold. They're still there. And I'm thinking, well, and in my mind, well, that's all right. That's pretty good odds, you know, for me if they're not selling all the tickets. And I said, well, mm-hmm. I said, Sarah, I said, what if I just go buy two more champagne glasses?
So that's what he did. $50. Two more glasses of champagne, and two more raffle tickets. Now they're holding four tickets. The event is just about over. Just one more thing. The raffle drawing. To announce the winner of the $7,500 diamond. Jason was listening, tickets in hand, as the number was read off.
And I happened to be kind of standing by him, but really not paying any attention at all to this drawing, because in my mind, they're going to read it off. We're not winning. So, you know, I'm just kind of socializing. And I hear him yell, actually, you know, I think it was, say that again. And I look at him and he reads those three numbers off. And I remember him like, winner. And I took the tickets thinking like, are you sure? You know, let me double check this right now.
So your first thought, Kristen, is I cannot wait to wear this diamond, which makes perfect sense.
I can't
sense.
Believe I got this beautiful diamond.
Jason, yeah. what's your first thought? Is your first thought also, man, Kristen will look so beautiful in that diamond?
Not at all.
No, it wasn't.
As a matter of fact, I had even joked, because I know him so well, I had joked to, you know, quite a few of our friends, neighbors were there, and they were just, you know, floored as well that we had won this. And they were all like, this
high
is,
fives
yeah,
going
high fives.
On
this is
going to,
oh, Kristen, this is going to be so beautiful. And I said, oh, yeah, come on, this is going on Craigslist tomorrow morning. You know, Jason, are you kidding? You know, I know my husband. Kind of joking.
Kind of joking, but mostly not joking. They went home that night, elated, still on a high from winning. But at home, it became obvious that Kristen's high was not the same as Jason's high. They started to bicker. They fought. Jason pleaded with Kristen to just go to sleep so they could talk about the diamond the next day.
In all honesty, you know, if we had $8,000 lying around, would I say, please go buy me a diamond? Absolutely not. I didn't ask for one when we got married. But it was kind of like, okay, this was given to us now. So now why do we have to turn this into cash? You know, why can't I just own it?
And Jason, I'm curious, what was it that made you so, you know, eager to think of a plan other than keeping the diamond?
I just looked at it as the opportunity to have that money to do something else than to have it be a piece of jewelry. We have rings or jewelry from family members that are, I would say, worth very similar to that that we would never sell.
It goes, I think, a little bit back into that kind of needs versus wants.
Did you have a plan, or you just knew that the plan was to not own a diamond that expensive?
You'd put it towards debt.
Laura Straussfeld, the Chekhov scholar we heard from earlier, says that Kristen and Jason's dilemma reminds her of a Chekhov short story called The Lottery Ticket. A married couple believe they may have won the lottery.
They go off in their fantasies about how they might spend the money, and the husband's imaginings are quite different from the wife's, and by the end, they're miserable.
And he looked at his wife, not with a smile now, no, but with hatred. She glanced at him too, also with hatred and anger. She had her own daydreams, her own plans, her own reflections. She understood perfectly well what her husband's dreams were, and she knew who would be the first to try to grab her winnings.
Chekhov always has his microscope on intimate relationships, and sort of more superficial moral might be that you bring some kind of windfall into an intimate relationship like a marriage, and you're worse off in the end from it.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, can Kristen and Jason resolve their dilemma without resorting to gunfire?
As a matter of fact, I think yesterday I said, well, you might come home and find it in a ring on my finger.
And is a diamond really as valuable as we think?
One of the great illusions of our time is that diamonds are forever valuable. They are not.
You want to know what's valuable? The entire Freakonomics podcast archive for free at Freakonomics.com. You can also subscribe to our free weekly podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
From WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
At a charity raffle, Kristen and Jason Serrata won a diamond, estimated to be worth $7,500. She wanted to wear it. He wanted to sell it, which meant that neither of them got what they wanted.
I would say we both did at one time say we wish we never would have won
it. We did.
It did get to that level.
One thing I did say to him was, if we're going to do something with it, let's do something with it. I don't want a year from now where it's still sitting in the laundry room and we haven't done anything. That is going to irritate me.
Yeah, I love that there were kind of two options here. One is for you to wear it and get this joy and utility out of it, and the other is to sell it, and instead you've taken the third, which is stick it in the laundry room, which seems to be like...
Right. It's just sitting there, you know, gonna gather dust. We now have something to do with this diamond, and we don't know what to do with it that will make us both feel okay with it. Because now we both have such negative feelings about it that whoever wins is not really winning. You know, we're both kind of losing, if that makes sense.
Did you figure out what you could get for it, roughly?
We did. If we sold it ourselves, we could get probably $4,000 to $5,000.
I wondered if the Serratas really could get $4,000 or $5,000 for their diamond. The jeweler who donated it estimated it to be worth $7,500, but what's the resale market like for a loose diamond? And taking a step further back, why are diamonds so expensive in the first place? Presumably, it's not only because people find them beautiful. It's also, presumably, because they're rare. They are rare, aren't they?
People believe that diamonds are rare. In fact, diamonds, at least in America, in terms of households who possess them, are the second most common item. The most common item is television sets. Children come in a distant third.
Okay, that may be a bit hyperbolic, but this man knows his diamonds.
I'm an investigative reporter, and diamonds is one of my favorite subjects.
His name is Edward J. Epstein. He's been writing about the diamond industry for decades, including a book called The Rise and Fall of Diamonds. He once performed an experiment that might prove relevant here.
While I was writing my book, I tried to sell a diamond.
First, he had to buy one. He went to New York's Diamond District on West 47th Street and paid $2,000 for a diamond.
I waited a week, and then I went around to other diamond dealers on 47th Street, and they were offering me things like $300 and $400. So I realized I was going to lose a great deal of money, which I did.
So the markup alone on diamonds, Epstein quickly learned, was very substantial.
So they weren't going to pay that when someone tried to sell it. And the diamond, of course, didn't gain in value, so you instantly lost 50 or 60%.
Epstein also wanted to learn how diamonds came to be so expensive and omnipresent.
The tradition of giving a diamond as an engagement gift really began in the 20th century. Before that, people didn't need a diamond to get engaged.
So how did this tradition get started? Okay, let's go back further in history. When you would see kings and queens from long ago wearing diamonds, the fact is that the stones were precious in part because they were hard to find. Prospectors had to pan for them in riverbeds.
Then in South Africa, in the city of Kimberley, they found geological formations called pipes. So blue material, giant diameters, they looked like something from outer space. And they found if they took a steam shovel, they could take this material out, which they called kimberlite, and extract diamonds from it. And suddenly, they could create as large a supply of diamonds as they wanted. Steam shovels were cheap, and diamond prices then fell to about $5 a carat, because there were so many of them. This was all in the 1880s. Then a man came along called Cecil Rhodes.
Cecil John Rhodes, as in Rhodes Scholarship Rhodes, as in the founder of Rhodesia, which is now Zimbabwe. Rhodes was also a pretty clever diamond magnate.
Who said, look, we're going to create a worthless semi-precious stone unless we do something. We have to restrict production to the measurable demand. And he got all the owners of the diamond mines together, and they created a cartel. And the purpose of the cartel was to restrict supply.
In those days, Epstein says, that was easy. Most of the world's diamond mines were in a relatively small area of South Africa.
He said, look, all we have to do is figure out how many people are getting engaged a year. If it's 500,000, we'll only allow 500,000 stones on the market. So they will always seem to be or appear to be rare, and the rest we'll just keep in a stockpile. So this worked.
The diamond syndicate Epstein is describing came to be known as the De Beers Mining Company. It grew to be synonymous with the diamond industry itself. But during the Great Depression, demand fell.
People just couldn't afford to buy diamonds. So De Beers stockpile in London, a giant vault, just kept growing. So at one point, Ernest Oppenheimer...
He's the man who had taken control of De Beers.
He actually entertained the plan of dumping the diamonds in the mid-Atlantic. In other words, they were better lost than ever reaching the market.
So, not exactly the intrinsically valuable item we think of diamonds as today. But as history would have it, World War II was good for the diamond industry. As diamonds are among the hardest known minerals on Earth, they were good for a variety of industrial uses.
You needed them to cut steel and make tanks and artillery. And the economies of the world perked up after the war, and De Beers never had to resort to such a drastic strategy.
It was also around this time that De Beers hired the advertising firm N.W. Ayer.
You know, everyone has seen Mad Men on television, where they were 100 times better than Mad Men. They actually understood that what a woman wanted was a tangible measure of love. So they made the diamond into the tangible symbol. They also introduced diamonds into Hollywood. They opened an office in Hollywood to put them in films. and its entire business was creating a liaison
Tiffany's
between movie producers and De Beers.
Cartier.
Songs like Marilyn Monroe singing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, you know, didn't come out of thin air.
A kiss on the hand may be quite continental, but diamonds are a girl's best friend.
They gave diamonds to movie producers. They said, here, for your wife, here's a beautiful diamond ring. What we want you to do is, in your movie, show that when the woman receives the diamond, the woman who is a virgin up to this point, suddenly jumps into the arms of the man giving her a diamond. That was actually all in their advertising strategy. They said that we have to show surprise followed by gratification. So the man believed that by surprising the woman, he was getting the woman. And the woman believed she was getting a tangible measure of his love. The bigger the diamond, the more the love.
N.W. Ayer also implanted the notion that diamonds are forever, and therefore not only a symbol of eternal love, but an investment.
The diamond engagement ring. How else could 2 months' salary last forever? A diamond is forever, De Beers.
Basically, the idea was that if you spent a month's salary on diamonds, you would have an investment on your wife's finger, which would grow and grow in value as if she was wearing a T-bill or a stock certificate. And women accepted this because the diamond was a lot more beautiful than a treasury bill.
De Beers' control over the diamond market has diminished in recent decades, largely as a result of antitrust regulations in the U.S. and Europe. But one thing that hasn't diminished, at least not much, the overwhelming belief in the monetary value of diamonds. And this, Epstein says, has helped the industry keep a handle on a huge source of diamonds that it does not control, a vast repository known as the overhang.
The overhang is every diamond ever sold in history that is on someone's finger or in a bank vault or in some drawer somewhere. So the only way it could stop people from selling diamonds they don't want anymore is by creating the idea that, so you're stupid to sell it and take cash and buy stocks or buy a car or buy a house, because the diamond will keep gaining in value while the others are risky investments. The moment people begin thinking, well, diamond is just another commodity, it goes up and down in value, then a huge number of diamonds could come on the market, not from any new diamond mine that's discovered, but from what people have in their bank safety deposit boxes.
I had to kind of figure out for me, what am I so angry about with this? And I think it just came down to, I wanted to just hear him say, if you really want this, then you can have it. You know, what I want, I will put that aside, my instant thoughts of how am I going to turn this into, you know, cash or whatnot. Because I knew it meant he would be, I don't know if conceding is the right word, but it meant he would be giving up something he is passionate about, which is needs versus wants, and we don't really need this, but if this is what you would like, we'll go that route.
So, Jason, you've never said that, I assume.
No, I wish I was a mind reader, though, because that would have really helped. And to say it now is just empty.
No,
doesn't mean.
Are you sure? Wait. Kristen, is that true? If you were to say it now, would you really think it's an empty statement?
No, I don't.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, I don't want to put you on the spot, nor do I know either of you well enough to offer what I'm about to offer, but do you want to take this opportunity with tape rolling to say that?
Yeah, I could.
No.
Honey, if you really wanted to keep it, I would be okay with it and try my hardest to never bring it up again.
I believe that to be true. I really do. You know, sometimes Jason, he is so laid back and I am so emotional that sometimes I take things that he does as I'm not a priority And that's kind of where I felt with this ring, like, you know, what I want to do with it is not a priority. He's going to do what he wants to do. And I kind of, so that's, I think I had to come to terms with or realize that it's really not actually even about this diamond. It's about something a little more. And in all honesty, do I really want this diamond? Do I still want it sitting in my laundry room? No, I think that's a poor use of it. It's either like, let's put it in something or let's sell it. But I do feel like, you know, you felt very passionately about finding something else to do with this. Then I'm leaving that up to you. Let's do it.
And I have to judge whether she is being 100% true with me, or let's say somebody comes to the door, hands me a wad of cash, does she go upstairs and, you know, get really angry with me?
No.
And so I've got to, in my mind, juggle some things, because if, you know, there would be resentment for me if she kept it, to be completely honest in one way. Well, she just didn't listen to me.
We ran the Serrata's Dilemma past Edward J. Epstein, the diamond writer.
Keeping the diamond is just being a prisoner of the illusion.
The illusion, that is, that a diamond is in fact rare and, therefore, inherently valuable. You remember that Epstein lost a lot of money trying to resell a diamond to diamond dealers, which is why he recommends something different for Jason and Kristen.
If you want to sell a diamond, you have to have as large a market as possible. So my advice to Jason and Christine would be to sell the diamond at an auction, and you might find someone else who's a prisoner of the illusion, and they might pay you a much better price.
We ran this idea past them, and they seemed to like it. A few weeks later, one of our Freakonomics Radio producers, Christopher Wirth, called the Serratas to see where they had landed with their diamond.
After discussing it with Kristen, we have decided to put it on eBay as an auction. And what we're going to do is donate 50% of the proceeds back to the charity that we won it from.
And so what led you to that decision? Because there was so much going back and forth. I mean, what was the deciding factor?
Well, like she said, she's going to get more mad at me the longer it sits there and does nothing. And so I just finally decided, okay, if I've gotten her to the point where she's willing to sell it, then let's sell. Let's take this opportunity. Let's sell it. Let's be able to give back to that charity. And then whatever amount comes at that point in time, then we can discuss what we would do with it.
Right. If it's not on my finger, it should actually be on somebody else's. So,
but there seemed to be some resentment on either side. I mean, you both described it as a case where neither person could really win in this whole thing. And that at one point you both said you wished you'd never won it. I mean, how are you feeling now in terms of, I guess, particularly you, Kristen, how are you feeling now that you've decided to go ahead and sell it?
Honestly, I feel really very good about it, especially because I don't feel strong-armed into this decision at all. I feel that this was something he and I came to together, and that was really important. I just wanted to feel like I had kind of a voice in what happened, or that I wasn't being forced to do something without considering the possibility of keeping it. And I truly believe that if I had said, you know what, I really want to keep this, I believe that he would have been okay with it.
So Kristen and Jason finally agreed to agree. Now, you'll remember the local jeweler said the diamond was worth $7,500, but Edward J. Epstein said that finding a jeweler to buy it would mean a markdown of probably 50 to 60% if you're lucky, so the most the Serratas could expect was maybe $4,000. Hearing Epstein's advice, the Serratas decided to auction the diamond on eBay. And here's the good news. The winning bid was nearly $6,000. But here's the bad news. That bidder turned out to be a phantom. Ultimately, a friend of the Serratas wound up buying the diamond from them for $5,000. So, turned out pretty well. And we are happy the Serratas got through their diamond ordeal, especially when you consider that
marriage, let's face it, is on the decline in many different ways.
We all knew that, right? But what do we not know about marriage? For instance, is Senator Marco Rubio right about this?
The greatest tool to lift people, to lift children and families from poverty, is one that decreases the probability of child poverty by 82%. But it isn't a government program. It's called marriage.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we look at the state of American marriage. There are a lot of different reasons why people get married.
We got married because we love each other.
To have a family, to probably continue with the tradition.
I'm Catholic, so tradition is a big part of our lives.
In India, it is a social thing to get married.
And there are a lot of reasons why people don't get married.
Marriage is a big commitment.
It doesn't make sense, the whole institution of marriage.
I prefer to being single than free.
I think finding a partner is damn hard.
So we decided to look at the numbers on marriage, and while we're at it, come up with a whole new idea for what marriage could be. Marriage today is fundamentally different than it was 50 or 60 years ago in the United States. It used to resemble what economists might call a factory model, with the husband as CEO, the homemaker wife as a sort of floor captain. Together, they created what you might call production complementarities. But today, here, I'll let the economist Justin Wolfers explain it.
We've moved to what economists would call consumption complementarities. We have more time, more money, and so you want to spend it with someone that you'll enjoy, so someone with similar interests and passions. We call this the model of hedonic marriage, but really it's a lot more familiar than that. This is just economists giving a jargon name to love. So you want someone actually who's remarkably similar to you or has similar passions that you do. So it fundamentally changes who marries who.
It also changed how many people marry. Here's the Harvard economist Claudia Golden.
Marriage, let's face it, is on the decline in many different ways.
That's right. Even though marriage is still more popular in the U.S. than in many wealthy countries, our marriage rate is at an all-time low. Okay, so who's still getting married and who isn't? Ivory Toldson teaches counseling psychology at Howard University and is a research analyst at the Congressional Black Caucus Foundation.
People who are less educated tend to be married less than people who are more educated. People who have higher incomes are more likely to be married than those who have lower incomes. And people in smaller cities are more likely to be married than people in larger cities. And that's true across all races.
Okay, what other traits affect marriage rates? Well, religion is still a driving force toward marriage, and as the U.S. grows less religious, that means less marriage. This may also explain why Western Europe has even lower marriage rates than ours. And what about immigrants to the U.S.? First-generation immigrants are more likely to marry. They may be more religious or traditional than their U.S. counterparts, but those numbers dip dramatically for the second and third generations. One area where marriage is rising is among gay couples, not surprisingly, since same-sex marriage has only recently been allowed. Since 2004, there have been an estimated 71,000 same-sex marriages in the U.S., with many more expected. So, not a huge number, but an upsurge nonetheless. And what about marriage rates by race? Let's look at the breakdown for men. Roughly 59% of Asian men in the U.S. are married, followed by white men at 54%, Hispanic men at 45%, and black men at just 36%. That low number for black men is especially an issue for black women.
I am Nina Bruce. I am a native Baltimorean, born and raised.
Like Nina Bruce.
I'm 32. I work for the government. And I'm actively dating in Baltimore and Washington, D.C. People want to know why you're single, which is a crazy question because you can't answer that sometimes. And they want to know what you're doing about it. So I've done everything. Speed dating. I did a lock and key party, Match.com. I've done eHarmony. And, of course, friends love to set me up. It's like, oh, I know the perfect person for you. Everybody knows the perfect person for you.
We asked Bruce why she wants to get married.
For me, marriage is important for a couple reasons. I would love to have that bond with someone. I think that is the core of why I want to get married. And also, economically, I want to have kids. And I don't want to have kids on my own.
But she hasn't been having much success.
It's hard to find someone who's in the same playing field. I mean someone who is not necessarily of the same background, but someone who, A, wants to get married, who, B, is able to get married and or be in a relationship, a healthy relationship, whether it be financially, physically, or mentally, even spiritually. It's important to me to date within my race. I think there's a lot of pressure. I would be open to dating outside of my race, but I think there's a lot of pressure.
Nina Bruce is worried about the availability of eligible black men to marry. Ivory Toldson, the Howard scholar we heard from earlier, says that black men are overrepresented in the categories associated with not being married, lower income, education, and living in bigger cities. But Toldson also says that the ratio of available black men to women in the U.S. is not as skewed as most people think.
So you have about 800,000 more black women with at least a bachelor's degree than there are black men. But there are more black men, about 300,000 more black men, who have incomes above $75,000 than black women.
Toldson analyzed data from Atlanta and Washington, D.C.
Both of these cities are seen as, you know, kind of these meccas of progressive black people. And so there was a lot of talk about, you know, the ratio. If you all went to either one of these cities and just asked someone randomly on the streets, you know, what's the ratio of black women to black men in the city? I guarantee you, unless they have read my research, they would say something above 10 to 1.
You guarantee us? All right, we'll take you up on that. We asked a bunch of people in Atlanta how many marriageable black women there are for every black man.
Ratio of black women to black men, I don't know. I'd say probably 3 to 1. There's a lot of ladies in Atlanta.
20 women for every one black guy.
I would say around 2 to 1.
I found a lot of women here have gotten to the point where they've dated so many guys that they're like, I've been flaked over so many times. It wouldn't hurt to try dating a female.
I think people's guard is up. Incarceration, having a big factor in it as well, and maybe even, you know, people not being employed.
Okay, and here's Ivory Toldson with the real answer.
So the true ratio in both of these cities is 1.3 to 1. Then, of course, if you get into the educated population, you'll see the ratio get even more skewed, and it goes up to about 1.8 to 1 in Atlanta and 1.5 to 1 in Washington, D.C. You know, if you're a young black woman and you want a educated black man, these corrected ratios may give you some comfort, but in real time, it still can be a challenge. You know, I'm not trying to put my brothers out there, but I know that some successful black men who are exposed to information like there's a 15 to 1 ratio in the city that you live in, they become less committal in relationships and more restrictive in what they believe they deserve. This is certainly not true of all, but, you know, if we're just looking at the entire landscape and how a lot of this information could be misused, that there is a tendency for some men to exploit the data.
As we've been hearing today, marriage has many causes and, therefore, many consequences, which means that politicians will inevitably find something to say about it. Here's Marco Rubio, the Republican U.S. Senator from Florida.
The greatest tool to lift people, to lift children and families from poverty, is one that decreases the probability of child poverty by 82%. But it isn't a government program. It's called marriage.
Is marriage really a poverty-fighting tool? Probably not as much as Rubio says. Yes, higher income is correlated to a higher marriage rate, but as Justin Wolfers told us earlier, a lot of the good things about married people are because of the people who choose to get married, not because of the marriage itself. That said, you can see why politicians care so much about marriage.
For one thing, unmarried women are one of the most Democratic voting constituency groups now in the country.
That's Celinda Lake. She's a Democratic pollster and strategist. She also co-wrote a book called What Women Really Want. She's also, in her own words, one of the political world's most avid whitewater rafters.
It's very relaxing and really fun. And we often do it in Glacier National Park, which is my favorite.
Lake says that men who aren't married split their votes between parties, although they do lean Democrat. But unmarried women are almost a Democratic voting bloc. A diverse bloc, yes, of young and old, rich and poor. Right now, they make up about a quarter of the voters in the U.S., but they don't turn out like their married counterparts.
We often talk, for example, about 22 million missing voters, 22 million unmarried women out there who don't vote. And so the question is, if they came in and when they come in, they can really determine what happens. We could easily say that there are enough votes among unmarried women to easily determine which party would control the House and which party controls the Senate.
Married women, meanwhile, are not nearly as monolithic, although there's a wrinkle to their voting patterns, too.
We ask married men and married women, do you usually vote the same way as your spouse? And 73% of married men said confidently yes, and 49% of married women said yes. And I call that the sure honey factor.
Celinda Lake has noticed one other marriage trend, really an unmarried trend, that is more dramatic than any of this. It's the number of unmarried women who are having kids.
In 1980, 18% of births were to unmarried women, and today it's 42%. I mean, that is a change within half of my lifetime. In just 6 years, half of every kindergarten class in this country is going to be the children of single moms.
This inevitably has political consequences and economic consequences.
Two-thirds of unmarried women say that there was some basic cost that they had in their families that they couldn't make ends meet in the last year, that they couldn't pay the bill, compared to 40% of married mothers.
So would these unmarried mothers necessarily be better off if they were married? To Celinda Lake, the answer is not so clear.
Does poverty produce being unmarried, or does unmarried produce poverty? It's a bit of a circular phenomenon, but it is still very much true that poverty, the pressures of poverty, are producing more single families. There's a very provocative article that was written and said, what single moms need is not marriage, but more childcare. In the immediate future, we just need a very, very different structuring of our social services.
For instance?
I think it's the question that hasn't been thought through very much at all. And I think that we don't have a legal structure, a societal structure, a political structure really ready to deal with this phenomenon.
So in a way, all the answers about marriage lead back to the same question. Is it good for us? As an institution, does it make us happier, healthier, wealthier, more stable in all the ways that we deem important? The fact is, that question is pretty hard to answer. The people who are more successful on all these levels are more likely to be married, but we can't say with any certainty whether marriage itself is responsible. But let's pretend for a minute that it is, that marriage, regardless of who the participants are, makes us better off. If that's the case, the downward trend in marriage is a bad thing, and it would be nice to reverse it. One barrier to marriage may be that it's such a big commitment, a permanent commitment, at least in theory. What if it weren't? What if you could change the terms of a marriage? We went back to our marriage expert, Justin Wolfers. All right, Justin, one last question let me ask you. This episode came about in part because of an email we received from a listener who writes, I'll read you one paragraph of his note. For about the last 6 years, he says, I've been developing a theory about how marriage should be legal social contracts. I feel that legal marriage, not marriage by the church, should be treated more like employment agreements. These, quote, marriage contracts should bring with them a term that ranges from 3 to 5 years. The terms of the contract will be developed by both parties, but I feel that they should include things like expectation, key areas of responsibilities, and so on. He goes on a bit for why this is so. I'm just curious how you think an idea like that might work. Would it defeat the very purpose that most people are seeking in a marriage? Would it enhance the strength of marriages that are good? Would it strengthen and release marriages that are bad? What do you think?
So I think from an economist's perspective, if what you're describing is a move away from a one-size-fits-all contract that's written by the church to a couple sitting down and writing their own contract, deciding what features are particularly important to them and what they want to promise to each other, you're moving from offering one product on the shelf, traditional marriage, to many products on the shelf, traditional marriage and all these other variants that happen to suit your lifestyle better. We usually think that increasing choice like that makes people better off.
Now, Justin Wolfers and his partner, Betsy Stevenson, they did draw up a marriage contract. It spells out terms of their finances and inheritance, hospital visitation rights, issues related to their two kids. Is your contract with Betsy renewable, or is it for the long run?
Oh, that's the part I didn't actually address. So your listener has a view that marriage contracts should be able to be rolled over in 3 to 5 years.
Right.
That's a part where, as an economist, I think what he's suggesting is he's removing the freedom to contract over longer periods. And that's actually a terrible idea. So think about some of the most important decisions you make together as a couple. You want to go to business school, and you want me to support you during that. You know, I'm willing to do that, but you know, the payoff to me from doing that comes in 10 years' time.
Mm.
So the only way we're going to be able to get to a place where I will support you through business school will be if I can write a 10-year contract. Basically, I think you want to let people write contracts of whatever duration it is that makes most sense to them. Now, we need to also be aware that people have psychological biases. My friends in behavioral economics are right about that, and sometimes we fail to understand the future well enough. So we want to write sophisticated contracts understanding our own limitations, but there's certainly a view that for things like supporting each other's careers or the major investments we make through children, that we want to be able to make much, much longer commitments than just 3 to 5 years.
On the other hand, if the problem with a failed marriage is that it failed, then a contracted marriage whose contract expires and is not renewed is not a failure. Would there not be an advantage to that?
So this is trying to draw a distinction between not being renewed and being fired.
Mm. Right, essentially. Not being – right, exactly.
I'm sure it's worth sitting down every few years and rather than just assuming the marriage is working out and continuing on, I'm sure it is worth sitting down and saying, is this employment relationship or is this marital relationship working out? And if it's not, seeing whether there are ways to fix it. And if it's not working out, then separating. And so if the idea is that we need a forcing mechanism to actually have that conversation, I think that, you know, it's important to have that conversation. That's the sense in which I say I think you want to be aware of our own limitations. And if your listener seems to think one of our limitations is we never go back and revisit the choices we made, if that's true for you, then you should build in an annual review.
Isn't that romantic? Yeah, you all seem to think so too.
No, I think that kind of ruins the commitment and the meaning behind it.
I think that'd be too much of an easy out for people.
That's what cohabitating is for.
No, I wouldn't want to do that. I like that we're kind of locked in.
Having children changes everything about a marriage, and I think the kids need a little bit of stability.
You have to renew it every day, every moment of your life, to maintain the true love.
It would take emotion out of it. It would become a business deal. I wouldn't like it.
That's something like NBA, ain't it?
So, I mean, maybe this contract thing could work. I don't know.
I'd rather have that for friends, yes, but not for marriage.
I told my husband last year, do you want a maid or do you want a lover? And he says, I want a lover. And I go, then we need to get a housekeeper. So I renegotiated a housekeeper last year.
Thanks for listening to Freakonomics Radio. We'll be back next week with more things you always thought you knew but didn't, and things you never thought you wanted to know but do. Talk to you then.